live. And what is a word like live anyway but a random series of letters? It's the Mike Novak Show. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night nor power outage nor computer freeze up. I think you know where I'm going with that. So let's just sing. Here we go.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
And thanks for taking a break from watching the days get shorter to listening to this show. As you know, I'm on iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, the GLN Radio Network, at MikeNovak.net, and on the Green Divas Global Digital Network at GDGDRadio.com, which means that no matter how you listen to the show, there's always someplace better and easier to find it. Ain't that the way of the world? By the way, check out The Mike Novak Show on Facebook and on Twitter. The handle is at Mike Now, or write to me anytime you like, Mike at MikeNovak.net. That's spelled MikeNowak. The entire show today is about something that pretty much everybody in America should remember. The explosion in the Gulf of Mexico of BP's Deepwater Horizon on April 20th, 2010. It killed 11 workers and unleashed an unstoppable flow of oil that gushed unabated for 87 days. The U.S. government estimates that about 5 million barrels, which is more than 200 million gallons of oil, poured into the Gulf of Mexico. But that's just an estimate. We'll probably never know exactly how much oil was released, just as we'll probably never know the extent of the environmental damage that was caused by the spill, even as its effects continue to unfold in slow motion year after year. We do know that in September 2014, a U.S. District Court judge found BP guilty of gross negligence and reckless conduct, and that in July of this year, the company agreed to pay $18.7 billion with a B, billion dollars in fines. To be sure, companies like Transocean and Halliburton were also fined, but not to the same extent. Today's show features my interview with one person, Lee Fondakowski, the head writer on the critically acclaimed The Laramie Project, who traveled to the Gulf Coast to interview the people who were most affected by the BP catastrophe, fishermen, political figures, cleanup workers, scientists, oil industry workers, and of course, the friends and loved ones of the people who were killed in the accident. Except it wasn't an accident, as Fondakowski points out in my interview. BP paid the fines for recklessness, and despite the money paid out, those 11 men are still dead. Lee and her team put more than 200 hours of interviews into a play called Spill, which is having its Midwest premiere at Timeline Theater in Chicago. I saw it, and I was surprised, moved, angered, and enlightened. It's a very good play and a very good production. The acting and staging are terrific, as is the writing, although a lot of it was done by the people down in the Gulf Coast in their interviews. And it runs through December 19th at Stage 773, 1225 West Belmont Avenue in Chicago. Despite the excellence of the production, I walked away from this piece with a sense of sadness, a knowledge that the only thing we know for sure is that this kind of tragedy will happen again. Yet, there's a faint sense of hope, as President Barack Obama finally rejected the building of the Keystone XL pipeline just this week, after a seven-year review of the project. Maybe we will figure out how to quit fossil fuels after all. The question is, will we do it in time to save ourselves? Once again, for tickets to Spill, the play, go to timelinetheater.com, theater spelled with an R-E. My conversation with Lee Fondakowski, playwright and director of Spill, begins right after this.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakenings Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. So if your sustainable business is anywhere in Lake or Cook County, we want you to be part of our magazine. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakenings than any other magazine to help lead happier, healthier, and greener lives. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Natural Awakenings is distributed in more than 1,000 Chicagoland locations, and our readers are looking for products and services just like yours. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
And then one day we were fishing for some food, and up from the Gulf came a bubbling goo. BP Halliburton Transaction.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. I'm in the rehearsal space, and that's why we have this wonderful echoey ambiance, or ambience, if you're in America. And this is at Timeline Theater Company in Chicago. Lee Fondakowski is the writer and director of the play Spill, which just opened in Chicago and is running through December 19th at Stage 773 at 1225 West Belmont Avenue. For more information, go to timelinetheater.com. Theater spelled with an R-E. Lee's credits include her work as head writer of The Laramie Project, which led to an Emmy nomination as the co-screenwriter for the adaptation of The Laramie Project for HBO. She's a member of the Tectonic Theater Project, and they spell theirs with an E-R. Let me say that's just a sampling of her work. You can find more at tectonictheaterproject.org. Thank you for sitting down with me today, Lee. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I saw your production, Spill, last week. Let me give you a little bit of background about where I'm coming from, you know, because I'm not NPR, all right? I'm a guy who does a show with my heart on my sleeve a lot. When I first came to Chicago 30-whatever years ago, I came to be an actor and ended up running a theater company for 10 years here, writing, directing, acting. So when I go to a theater piece, I'm looking at it from that point of view. However, in the intervening years, I became a radio host and an environmentalist. So now I have both of these backgrounds. And stepping into that theater and sitting there for 2.5 hours, and yes, folks, it's 2.5 hours, and you won't believe how fast it goes. I was impressed. You did everything theater's supposed to do: entertain, inform, create emotions in your audience, more and more. So the first thing I want to say is congratulations on a job well done.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And the second thing I want to say is I'm wondering if you've seen the headlines. You know, you've been very busy here, and I'm sure you're tweaking. You continue to work on the play.
that TransCanada has decided to ask the U.S. State Department to suspend its review of the presidential permit application for the Keystone XL pipeline. And I saw that headline and I thought, well, this is something I'm going to talk to Lee about, because this is connected to your play Spill, which involves the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. And somehow, in your mind, I would think, and it's certainly in mine, that those two events are connected.
The XL pipeline and the BP oil spill?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think spending time down south in that part of the country, in Louisiana in particular, and seeing the infrastructure that's in place down there, and how the economy of Louisiana basically is pretty much sustained by the oil industry. When I hear people say we should stop drilling in the Gulf, I think, my God, like what would happen to Louisiana? So it's almost like a little bit of a depressing reality down there, how far down a certain road we've come. And even when I would bring up the XL pipeline to people who I interviewed, they would say, well, we're just going to get that oil down here to Louisiana in one way or another, whether we have that XL pipeline or not. So definitely was a drumbeat of drill, baby, drill for most of my time in Louisiana. And I think one of the more shocking moments was sitting down with the families who lost their kids and their husbands on the rig. And from my perspective, 100% thought that they would be speaking out against drilling. And across the board, 99 cases out of 100 people were saying, no, we need to keep drilling. We need to keep drilling for the country. So that mentality, that identity as an oil-producing place, I didn't find a lot of soul-searching or a lot of questioning going on in Louisiana throughout my time there.
Okay, and I have to make a comment here because of the Chicago Tribune review came out today, and in that review, he wants the answers. He wants you to come out and say, well, here's why those people stay there. And I think what your play is showing is that we don't know. It's the land is being degraded even as we speak and has been for years, and yet it's a Faustian bargain that the people have made because they want the jobs, and those are good paying jobs. What's the price for it? Ultimately, it might be too much, don't you think?
I think ultimately it is too much, but I think that mentality is so entrenched that I would find it difficult to imagine, at least in the current generation, how that mindset's going to shift. Although one good thing that did come out of this, in the 70s in Louisiana, there was an environmental movement that sort of died down and fell apart in the early 80s. And that movement is resurrected as a result of this spill, sort of the tipping point to galvanize an environmental movement down there and an effort to sue the oil companies to restore the marsh. To repair the damage that they've done. So that is one good thing, one positive thing that I could see. But even though, you know, if you look at the economy down there, and the really good paying jobs are the offshore jobs, those jobs are going to people from all over the world. They're not necessarily going to the people who live in Louisiana, but the people of Louisiana believe that to be true. And it's sort of like they're holding that stake in the ground, that if we didn't have oil, we would literally die. We would literally fall off the planet if we didn't have this industry here.
I don't believe that's true, okay? And there must be other people down there who don't believe that's true.
I'm sure there are, and there are people, more people, the people that I spoke to want to hold the oil companies accountable. They don't want to get rid of them, but they want to hold them accountable. So that was the predominant...
But you know that doesn't happen. In real life, it almost never happens. Look at the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. That is still not fully resolved, and that was in 1989.
Yeah, that's still being litigated.
Right.
Yeah.
What happens. It goes into the courts, and they have the money to keep it going in the courts, whereas people need to get on with their lives.
They do. And I have to say that, I'm not going to defend BP because BP, was found guilty of criminal negligence, and this was a criminal act. That was my one little among many with the Tribune article, is Chris Jones called it an accident. And it was not an accident. It was a criminal act, what happened on the Deepwater Horizon. It was not an accident. It was a criminal act.
I'm finding it hard to imagine how he got so much of it wrong. I'm not sure where the guy's coming from, and we'll just let that go. But
yeah.
I think one of the things you do really well in the play Spill, first of all, you remind people of this, okay? This was headlines every day, and oil was gushing out into the Gulf of Mexico every day, and millions of gallons of it ended up in there. And yet as a country, as you know, we have the memories of guppies. We do not remember. So what you did in reminding people, I think, is important. And it's almost as if, you know what, every 5 years we have to remind people of what happened down there.
I think so, and I think that that whole summer where you saw that spill cam in the corner of the TV on all the major news networks, that was a horrific summer. It was a horrific summer for anyone to be staring at that spill cam. But one of the things that always strikes me, that was 5 million barrels that was spilled in that 87 days, and the U.S. consumes 21 million barrels of oil every day. So it's the four times the amount of oil that was spilled in the Gulf every single day we consume. So that's one of the things that I hope when people see spill is to draw that line between these extraction methods and our own consumption.
There was another moment of recognition for me in the play. Well, first of all, you have to understand that when I walked in and I started witnessing your production, it brought all those memories back for me, because doing what I do,
sure,
I was very concerned about it, very involved in it. But there's a line in the play that speaks to my own feelings at the time, and I forget who says it, and it's about how there was a news report on television where they talked about the spill, and this was shortly afterward, maybe a couple of months, I'm not exactly sure how long, and the guy said there was no mention of the 11 deaths. And he realized that this was going to be the case from now on. I wrote that down because that's how I felt. I would find myself screaming at the television saying, what about the 11 people who died? What happened to that?
Yeah, that's true. I was working with some students at Princeton University recently, teaching a playwriting class, and one of their assignments was to read Spill. And these Princeton students didn't know that there were 11 people who were killed. So it is something. I mean, these are Princeton students; they're bright, you know, young adults. But there is something about that, about how I don't know if it's that those lives aren't thought of in the same kind of way that other lives are thought of. It's curious to me, when I was working, I go around the country and talk about the Laramie Project often, and I was giving a talk back after a Laramie Project production, and a woman asked me what I was working on, and I told her a piece about the BP oil spill, and she literally put her hand up like this in front of her and said, well, that's a different kind of sadness. Like she was pushing it away, you know, and I was very struck by that. What does that mean, a different kind of sadness? Those 11 men are not worthy victims in the same kind of a way that Matthew Shepard is a worthy victim. And I was really struck by that. And I was pretty determined after that to make a play in which the audience could really empathize and sympathize with those men out there, the fears that they go through, their ambition and their fear, and you know how dangerous it is to be out there. But I really wanted the audience to go on a journey with those rig guys, to not be able to distance themselves from the reality of who gets that resource for all of us, who's out there doing that work.
Getting back to that and the idea that the people who died were somehow forgotten, why do you think that is? Is it because it was out of sight and that bodies were never recovered? It was on this platform that went up like a Roman candle, and so it was so spectacular that the human part of it was lost, perhaps?
It's curious to me, because if you think about the Chilean coal miners, right, 33 of them escaped from that coal mine, and there was a... all watching to see, were these men going to survive? Were these men going to survive? And there was like a human drama involved in getting, I think, people connected to those people who survived. In this case, as you say, you know, as we say in the play, those men died instantly. They were incinerated. And so there is a way in which it's like, oh, they're gone. I don't want to think about that. That the reality of that kind of death is so horrific that it's almost that you just don't want to think about it. You want to put it out of your mind. I also think there could be, I don't want to say prejudice, but almost a prejudice in thinking, well, those guys make good money. I've heard comments like that down there. Those guys make good money. They know the risk. You know, why should we be so sad for them? They should have seen this coming. You know, that kind of idea.
But the point in your play is they did see it coming. And there was nothing they could do to stop it because the company leaned on them.
And the corporate machine was doing its thing, of course, yeah.
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 So, and afterward, the corporate machine did its best to sort of cleanse their responsibility to it, even though, as you say, they were found guilty of negligence. Still, have all the people been paid there?
I do think that BP did a good job of compensating people. It took a long time for the fishermen to get paid, but it's not a case as an Exxon Valdez where the litigation is going to go on for decades. People will get paid. It's been 5 years, but people will get paid. I have to say, on not to defend BP, but on this point, I think they have tried to do due diligence to pay people, to compensate people.
Do you think it's because there were lives lost?
I think it was because it was such a public event, and I think, you know, not to be too cynical, but I think from a PR standpoint, they wanted to look like they were doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in their hearts, maybe they did really want to do the right thing, but I know that they certainly wanted to appear as if they were doing the right thing.
I'm talking to Lee Fondakowski, writer and director of the play Spill, about the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, running at the Timeline Theater in Chicago. More information at timelinetheater.com, theater spelled with an R-E. More of our conversation after this on the Mike Novak Show.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Sound red alert. Shields up. Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe, author of my favorite children's stories.
Captain, I am attempting to access a copy of the masterpiece. It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
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 Yes, Mr. Watt.
Yes, Captain. Aroundtheblockpress.com.
How many times can I say it?
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. We're talking to Lee Fondakowski, writer and director of the play Spill at Timeline Theater in Chicago, running through December 19th. I must compliment you on the staging. The first act, okay, I knew that it was going to be a long first act in terms of theater. Anything over an hour is considered long, and it's about an hour 10. At least it was on opening night. Didn't feel like it. And I loved your staging. I loved the idea of creating the catastrophe on stage with no blood, with some sound, a little bit of smoke, and the rest of it theatrical magic. I thought that was quite moving.
I really loved the collapsible set. I think it's pretty brilliantly designed by my set designer, Sarah Lambert. It's deceptively simple. You walk into the theater and you think, oh, this is a very minimalist set. But then you realize as the act unfolds that there are many, many moving parts to that set, and each part is going to move and shift and break apart, so that the second act actually takes place inside the wreckage of the disaster, which I also thought was a very poetic theatrical gesture. The first image of the second act is the CEO, Tony Hayward, sitting in the middle of the stage, surrounded by all the wreckage and all the carnage of Act One. And I think that sort of sets the second act in motion in an interesting way.
I think it's also interesting that you didn't set him up to be evil incarnate.
Yeah, I really wanted to humanize Tony Hayward. I mean, if you look at some of his testimony, in his deposition in the criminal case, he forgot the names of the men. He was asked to repeat the names of the men, and he couldn't remember. There were a lot of things where, if you put it out there, he would look very bad. But I didn't want to, he's an easy target, and I didn't want the play to become about bashing on BP. I really wanted to put him in there because he stands for the whole industry. Industry-wide, they were not prepared for this. You know, when Shell talks about going to the Arctic, from knowing what I've researched in this, I can guarantee you that the spill plans are not adequate for dealing with under the ice blowout in the middle of winter. So I really wanted to put him forward, not as an indictment of BP, but as an indictment of the industry-wide hubris to think that, oh, nothing like this will ever happen. And if it does, we'll deal with it. You know, they were not prepared, and they had not mitigated the risks to any extent, really, for that deep water drilling.
Makes me wonder, how the hell could the Obama administration allow Shell to even try to go up there and drill?
It's pretty shocking, actually. I think it was called the Kubrick, the first rig that got trapped out there. Mm-hmm. That first attempt was so disastrous. And showed that we really don't have the technology to do it. I found it quite shocking that they were given the green light to try again. I really, given that first attempt and how disastrous and how obvious it was that they were not prepared, I was really quite shocked. It really feels to me like they're sort of making it up as they go along, and that was a lot of what I discovered with the Deepwater Horizon and with deepwater drilling in general, that drilling is not an exact science. They have, seismic readings, and they estimate things, and the margins of error are so small. And that type of risk is done every single day on wells. So to imagine going into the Arctic is actually pretty terrifying.
I'm talking to Lee Fondakowski, writer and director of the play Spill, which just opened in Chicago and is running at Timeline Theater. This play is about the BP spill in 2010, April 20th. I think it's remarkable, and I noted at the time, 2 days before Earth Day. Yay, good for us. You got down there in a hurry. How soon after the spill did you show up on the Louisiana coast?
It was after the oil had stopped spewing, so it was in that following fall that I went down there. And I first went down with a group of Wesleyan students. I was asked by Wesleyan University to teach a class on these theater-making techniques. So I went down with a scientist because we were going to co-teach the class and kind of scout things out. And then we took the students down, and they did some interviews, and they made artwork. And then I started in earnest and doing my own research and interviews for the project. But I kept going down there. My last trip was last June. So for the past 5 years, I've probably made about 12 trips down.
All in anticipation of doing this play. When did you get to the point where you realized that you had to put this on stage?
Well, we premiered it in Baton Rouge last year. And I think with that premiere, we really wanted to bring the stories back to the community. That's the closest regional theater to Southern Louisiana. We wanted to bring the stories back to the community first. But now that the play has a national life, and hopefully will continue to have an even bigger life beyond Chicago, the play has a chance to breathe in a way that it didn't when we were down there. It was sort of the pressure of, like, how are they going to feel about what we did, and are they going to approve? And it was very well received there. Which made me feel very good in bringing it to the rest of the country.
But I'll bet you got some comments while you were down there. I mean, there must have been some reaction. As you said, it was well received. In what ways was it not well received?
You know, it's interesting because it was not well received before people saw it. There's a very strong perception that a New York artist was going to come in and, you know, wag my finger at them and tell them all about it and what's wrong with how they live and what's wrong with, how, you know, everything down there. And there was a presumption that I was making an anti-oil piece. And I think when people saw it, they were shocked that it didn't have, you know, an anti-oil rhetoric. I don't think the piece is pro-oil or anti-oil. I think the piece is trying to lay out the dilemma that we're in as a nation, that I don't think that people are aware that, you know, oil production has peaked globally. So now if we're going to keep using oil, we're going to be going into more and more dangerous extraction situations to get it, more and more damaging to the environment, more and more damaging to people. And I don't know that people are entirely aware of how dangerous this industry has become. And so for me, writing the play was about exposing that and about exposing our complicity, right? Because we're all consuming this product that they're extracting and that they're, you know, producing. And so I really wanted to make the play about that complicated situation that we're in.
And that becomes, of course, an analogy for tar sands, as we talked about at the beginning of this interview. It becomes an analogy for fracking, extracting the oil and gas. As you mentioned, the days of Jed Clampett are long past, where the oil was just bubbling up from the ground. Now we have to go through superhuman methods just to get it.
And highly toxic methods. Yeah, one of our characters at the end of Spill says precisely what you just said, the days of poking hole in the ground, the oil comes out, are over. You know, we've gotten into extraction systems that are so complex that, you know, the failures are just catastrophic, right? And so the question is, why do we continue to go down this road when clearly we need to reverse course and start thinking about a different future?
Has anybody thrown the word agitprop at you about this play?
Yes. People in Louisiana were tweeting that I was bringing my agitprop to Louisiana.
And this is before the show opened?
This was before the show opened. But I think that people were surprised at how even-handed the play was. I don't consider my work political theater. I know that people consider this subject a political subject and so put Spill in a category of political theater, but I think of it as human story and human theater, not political theater. And the undercurrents of politics are there, but I'm not coming out to make a political statement as much as I'm attempting in an artistic way to expose this human drama and to touch people's lives and to have people think about things differently.
Do you feel at all self-conscious about creating art / theater from real events?
Not anymore. I've been doing it for 20 years, and I've gotten pretty comfortable with it. And the contract that I set out with my interviewees and the ethics that I have around making sure they feel included, making sure that they feel represented authentically, I feel comfortable. I feel comfortable doing this work, but I continue to be surprised by it, and I continue to be sort of astounded by the poetry inherent in an average conversation with someone, the poetry of the vernacular, and how people say such incredibly beautiful things that you could never write. And so creating a play using actual words from people is a very fulfilling art form.
In terms of percentages, how many of the words in this play would you say were spoken live to you in interviews, and how many you wrote?
Probably 90 to 10. 90% the real words, and 10% me, you know, rounding out sentences and things like that. But it's predominantly their words.
All right, give me a first meeting, or not even a first meeting, but an introduction that you would make to somebody on the Louisiana coast about wanting to interview them and why you're doing it.
I would talk about myself as a playwright, which usually people sort of look at you like twice, like, playwright? And then they would say, you're writing a movie? No, I'm not writing a movie, I'm a playwright. So you kind of go over that little hurdle. And then usually I just start to talk to people about how they were affected, you know, by the spill, and explained to them that I really wanted to take the stories of the people who were affected and bring them to the rest of the country. And usually that would stir in people a pretty strong response. You want to tell the rest of the country what's going on down here? I'll tell you what's going on down here. And they would just start to tell their story. It wasn't hard to get people to talk. People were very hurt by this. They were very wounded. They were very frightened. They continue to be very frightened.
And as well they should be. I'm very frightened by it, and I've never been within 500 miles of Louisiana.
Yeah. Unprecedented amounts of dispersant used in this bill that had never been used before and the ways that it had been used in this bill. And people were worried about the health effects, the long-term health effects, the damage to the environment, the long-term damage that's still, you know, it's still unfolding down there. So it really wasn't hard to get people to talk. I think people felt very forgotten, especially after the spill stopped, the actual leak was contained. I think people felt forgotten. And so if you went down there tomorrow, people would want to talk about this oil spill.
One of the things you talk about in the play and that we chatted about a little bit earlier is that Faustian bargain that people make. It's not just the oil, but the oil industry has had a lot to do with it. One of the things I've studied in my environmental work is the damage we've caused to the swamps in the lowlands in Louisiana. One of the ways is by cutting down cypress trees, which we have done for lumber. We've pretty much wiped out all of the old growth down there. And one of the, and I heard in the play people talking about storm surge and how the swamps protected the cities and the lands from storm surge, and part of that was the cypress swamps. And that's aggravated by the channels that that are built for the oil industry. It's aggravated by the levees, believe it or not. Folks say, well, you know, it was a terrible disaster that the levees failed during Katrina. And I want to say, you know what? It was a terrible disaster that we built the levees in the first place, because all that silt and all those nutrients used to go out into those swamp forests and create nutrients for those trees. And this is all part of a whole. It's not just the oil industry, but it's everything we do as human beings seem to have a bad effect on the environment around us.
Yeah, it's really a complicated situation. You touched on all of it. There's also, you know, 1,000 locks and dams all along the Mississippi River, like as far up as, you know, Minnesota and all the way down. And so everything that gets dumped into the Mississippi makes its way down to Louisiana and makes its way into the Gulf. So there's dead zones from, you know, all the pollution there. And it is a very, very complicated situation down there with the marshes. But they are losing the marshes at an alarming rate. And the amount of spills that they have in Louisiana, one biologist told me that they have 1,000 spills a year in Louisiana, and that most of the spills are due to direct violations of existing regulations. So it's just that Baton Rouge just fails to enforce the law. And basically,
and you're talking oil spills.
Talking oil spills, thousands of spills. Could have easily been prevented by just having certain protective measures in place. And since Baton Rouge doesn't issue fines very often, just sort of turns a blind eye to it, the oil companies basically get away with murder down there.
Probably everywhere is what I'm thinking as I'm listening to you is, okay, tens of or thousands of spills there, tens or maybe hundreds of thousands of spills all over the country. I mean, Texas as well. We've got other states that have heavy oil industry. Alaska, we know about. California, we had a spill last year. I believe this year. It just goes on and on.
Yeah. You know, when Tony Hayward testified in front of the House of Commons, they asked him, okay, Mr. Hayward, well, what would prevent this from happening in the North Sea? And he said, well, this would never happen in the North Sea because we regulate the North Sea. And as soon as he said it, he always wanted to put the words back into his mouth, right? But he spoke the truth that there are areas of the world that are not regulated at all. If you go to Venezuela, you go to places in Africa, just no regulation. And the oil companies seem to not be capable of regulating themselves.
But as you point out, United States is one of those places. We are the Wild West here.
We are, but each state is different. I mean, you don't see this kind of thing happening in Florida. Florida has protected its coastland. When the Everglades were deteriorating, Florida brought them back. So Louisiana seems to be really, in terms of you know, the oil lobby controlling the government seems to be one of the worst in the country.
Well, I've got lots more I want to ask you, Lee. We need to take a little break here, and we'll be back with Lee Fondakowski, who is the creator of the play Spill, running at Timeline Theater in Chicago through December 19th. If you want more information about that, go to my website, mikenowak.net, MikeNowak.net. We'll be right back on The Mike Novak Show.
I work for an outfit that is trying to take over the country, but in a good way. Here's what I mean. I write a column for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, and that magazine is published by the same folks who publish magazines in 21 states, from Minnesota to Florida, from Pennsylvania to Oklahoma. They're called State by State Gardening, and in most of the Midwest and the South, you can get your hands on a magazine that is going to teach you a lot about gardening in your own state. These great publications feature articles by some of the leading garden experts in each state, including famous authors, nursery owners, state extension agents, master gardeners, and even me. Well, you can't hit a home run in every at-bat. And who knows, if your state doesn't have a state-by-state gardening magazine, they might very soon. Subscribe today by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600.
Welcome back to the Mike Novak Show. I happen to have an audio clip from the production of Spill at Timeline Theater in Chicago. Lee, let's take a listen to this.
The next day, the truck ride to the airport, Jason drove. Usually I drove so he could sleep, but Jason wanted to drive. He had me write everything down, everything. What he wanted done, how he wanted it done, what went to who and all that. We were drawing up his will. That's what we were doing. And before he got out of the truck, he looked at me and he said,
"Shelly, if anything had happened to me out there on that rig, would you and the kids stay in the house?"
"Jason, you're scaring me."
"Just tell me."
"Probably not. I mean, if I met someone else and we married, I wouldn't do that. You're all over that house. That house is your house. Wouldn't be fair to the new man." And then I said, "To be clear, I don't want a new man, okay? I don't want a new man." He said,
"Well, that's good, because I don't want to look down from heaven and see you making love to no new man neither, especially not in my own house. That'd kill me twice."
And we both laughed. He made me laugh every day. Well, that's a good reason to get married. Then he just looked at me. He smiled that crooked smile with his eyes barely open. "As an oil field wife, you understand the risks. It's a high-risk job, life or death. We all know that, but it's like you never think it's going to happen to you. Not your man. Your man is brave, and he's strong, and so your mind just tells you, he'll make it. He'll make it through."
I read an interview you did with the artistic director here at Timeline about how you might be interviewing somebody and something would click in your head. You heard something and said, "That's probably going to be the foundation of a scene." Is that how that works?
That is how it works. Usually when people are talking to me, I begin to hear the play coming to life. And when I sit down to transcribe, as I do all my own transcribing, that's sort of the second level.
You don't farm that out, huh?
I do not farm it out, because it's a very big part of my writing process, is to hear the words, to ingest the language, the rhythms of a character, and to discover the text that's the usable text for the play. So I edit as I go. Like, I'll be transcribing, you know, word for word, but then I'll highlight the sections so that by the end of the transcript I have a highlighted, you know, document of the full transcript, and that's sort of the beginning of the writing process for me.
How is this different from the Laramie Project?
Well, the Laramie Project, we had 10 people doing the interviews. So everybody sort of went out across the town and did their own interviewing. And then we came together as a group and presented the material and kind of crafted the material together as a group. In this case, my colleague, Riva Wortel, who's one of my dramaturgs, she was with me on the interviews. But I did all the interviews myself and transcribed them all myself. So it was a solo project in a way that was different from Laramie.
Did you do that because you felt you needed that control on the project?
I don't know if I would use the word control, but I love the collaboration that we did on Laramie. But fighting for your artistic point of view, I just was tired of fighting. I wanted to fight myself. I didn't want to argue with a group of people why I thought something was important to go in. So the only battles that I'm waging are with myself, you know. I think the biggest battle is like the dramatist in me versus the humanist in me. Like the humanist wants to tell everybody's story, and the dramatist knows that things have to be trim and things have to tell a story. And so that's the biggest battle that wages inside of me, of wanting to include everybody and knowing that I can't. But I guess wanting to do it solo is just about wanting to just be able to do my thing without having to prove to a group of people why I want to make that choice.
Been there, done that. Yeah. I noticed doing some reading that Riva Wortel, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
She did portraits of their interviewees, and you used that in an earlier production. Why didn't you use those in Chicago?
Well, we had the portraits in Baton Rouge. They're life-size portraits. They're actually like 6-foot-tall portraits, and so it was just the constraints of the space here in Chicago that we didn't have the portraits here with us. But the portraits exist as their own installation. So Riva is going around the country with the portraits as their own entity, and hopefully at some point in the future the play and the portraits can come together again.
So how did Spill come to Chicago?
Spill came to Chicago because of Kelly Simpkins, who plays...
Who is marvelous.
Yes, she's incredible. Actor.
She yeah. really is. And one of the moments, I'm sorry to interrupt,
no,
is at the very beginning of the play when the audience is settling in and trying to understand what's going on. It's very early in the play, and you've got... all the characters are on stage, and at the beginning a couple of them say things and take certain roles, and she's playing a role of the interviewer, which is you, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then she spins around and plays a character, and you go, oh, okay, this is not exactly what I had in mind. And then other people do the same thing, and that's nice. But she does it with such aplomb, and right at the beginning where you need to sell that idea of how you're presenting this play, that I think it works very well.
Thank you. And her transformation is just so spot on also. She's been doing this kind of work for a long time. And she's a terrific collaborator and a terrific performer. But she had a relationship with Timeline Theater, with Nick Bowling. She had done Indoor 4 with Nick. And so when we were in Baton Rouge and I was looking for, you know, the next home for Spill, she said, you really should send it to Timeline. And I didn't know these guys, so I was like, okay, I'll trust you, Kelly. But it turns out that they're wonderful, wonderful artists and human beings, and it's been great working with them. They're some of the hardest working people I've ever worked with, this whole company.
And I noticed she also works with About Face Theater here in Chicago.
I did, and I worked with ATC. PJ Paparelli was a dear friend of mine, and we're so sorry to have lost him this year. But I also have done work at About Face with Heather Schmucker and Eric Rosen, and at ATC with PJ.
And that takes us again to the production here at Timeline. One of the things that I enjoyed as a theater person, having a theater background, I was... I don't know if you know Mike Nussbaum, but in Chicago, yeah, he's been in Men in Black. He's been in,
yeah.
He was one of Mamet's stable of actors. He's been around forever. I think he's like in his upper 80s now. I mean, and still vibrant. And he directed a play. I co-wrote a play with him and two other people at my theater company, and he directed it. And he would give advice about scenes and scene changes, and he would come to see other productions and see previews and then take us aside and say, you know, if that scene change takes that long in the production, people will be walking out the door. I mean, just brutally honest mm-hmm. stuff. And one of the things I was really impressed with in your production was the changes. They just go like this. And I'm wondering if this is a carryover from past productions or something that evolved here, but you just move with lightning speed from one, you know, you don't give, there's no sense, you know, you've been to plays where, and now there's a scene change and we have music and there's darkness and people moving things on stage. None of that stuff in this show.
Yeah, it's a fast-moving show. It is a little bit of a carryover from some of my past work, but there's not really much space in the show. The characters are, the idea is that the characters are actually speaking as a collective whole. So they're not giving stage to each other as much as they're taking stage from each other and carrying this show forward, carrying the momentum of the story forward. So it really is a group of people or a community telling a story as opposed to, you know, a traditional play that has a single protagonist. In this play, the community is the protagonist. And so, yes, it unfolds pretty quickly.
It can be dangerous for a playwright to direct her own work. I know that from experience. And yet you like bringing your particular vision, but you always learn things along the way. And I'm wondering what different happened here in Chicago that you weren't expecting.
Well, the two really go hand in hand for me, the directing and the writing. The director teaches the writer in me how to write. So I couldn't write without my director intervening. And teaching me about the theatrical event that I'm making. But what I learned here, I set aside a week to work on the second act at the beginning of rehearsal, and nothing really caught fire. So I left it alone and I worked on the first act. And once the ensemble started to come together and really start working as an ensemble, the second act almost just unfolded in this incredibly organic way. That was really unique to this particular group of people. And so I guess, learned again, sort of an old lesson about just the organic process of theater making and how you can kind of hope and wish and push for something to happen, but it's actually going to happen in its own time. And so I think one of the biggest challenges of theater making is to live in that with that uncertainty of not knowing what's going to happen, but trusting that something will happen, something will emerge that is organic and beautiful and born of this group of people who are exploring the subject.
It has to be unique because it's a unique set of folks who are performing it.
It is, and I think the way I work with actors, I don't consider them just actors. I consider them my collaborators. And so I call upon them to brainstorm with me and I ask them for their input and I give them exercises to help me illuminate staging ideas or illuminate the text. And I really consider them fellow artists and fellow theater makers as much as performers. But then at the end of the process, after the play is sort of locked, then the director in me just takes over and just directs performances and does, you know, what a traditional director would do.
All right, that's what I have to ask. What have I missed? Is there something that you're itching to say that nobody has asked you before?
I think what I would just like to add, given the subject of environmentalist and environmentalism, there's not very many plays in America that are talking about the environment and that are talking about environmental issues. And I think it's important that the theater begins to talk about these issues because they're really, you know, the most important issues of our time. You know, the degree of extinction that's happening around us. You know, climate change that's evident all around us. You know, the extreme weather events and, you know, unpredictable weather patterns. And we're all living in a time that we've been kind of bracing ourselves for, and that's here. And I think that for me, it's important that the theater is part of the conversation about where we're going as a society and where we're going as a human species. I want the theater to be part of that dialogue, and I hope that Spill is a tiny part of it.
That's Lee Fondakowski. She is the writer and director of the play Spill, which is running at Timeline Theater in Chicago. For more information, go to timelinetheater.com. All of that will be there. I'm going to make you do one more thing for me, which is
okay.
The end of my program.
Okay.
Just say, go green or go home.
Go green or go home.
Gordon didn't talk about life on the rig a lot. He didn't volunteer very much. Now, I'll never know for sure, but sometime before the explosion, they sent out a company man, a senior man, with BP calls the shots, and he had the tool pusher really putting a lot of pressure on that drill bit to drill faster and faster. Now, he was sent out to the rig, say, hey, listen, we need to finish this well, get on to the next one. So that's what the tool pusher did what he said. And, as a result, they had what they call on the rig, lost returns. And that means he drilled all the way through that rock formation, so they cracked open at the bottom. And all of that drilling mud leaked out of the bottom of the well. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of drilling mud that just leaked out into the center of the earth, lost forever. That's why they call it that, lost returns.
He pauses. This man who lost his son looks as if he's trying to pull his son's last moments, last hours, last minutes out of thin air.
You know, Gordon's grandfather was a trial lawyer. His father is a trial lawyer. His brother's a trial lawyer. Gordon could have never been a trial lawyer. To be a successful litigator, you have to have a mean bone in your body somewhere, and Gordon didn't have that. He didn't have it. But I do. I want justice in this case. I want BP to pay for what it did.
You can find more information about The Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.